Welcome to episode 119 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, a family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
Hi, I'm Gary Ferencik, a general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPalms. We're about a week behind. We took a little break over the winter solstice celebrations and hope that all of you were warm, dry, and safe during the winter holiday. And in this upcoming new year, we wish you all good health, peace, and prosperity. I also want to give a little bit of a plug. On January 16th, Gary and I are going to be speaking with the North Dakota Academy of Family Physicians annual meeting at their Big Sky Conference in Big Sky, Montana. I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. Always a great meeting, great location. On this podcast, we highlight poems, patient-oriented evidence that matters. If you want them all, subscribe to Essential Evidence Plus. You can get a poem every day in your email, plus a great primary care reference. Over 800 chapters, thousands of interactive tools, EssentialEvidencePlus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. You can also get CME credit for listening to the podcast. Just answer a few questions at IAFP.com. Click on their online education webpage and find our podcast this week. Pharmacotherapy for insomnia in adults. What is the best time of day to take blood pressure meds? Chlorthalidone versus hydrochlorothiazide for treating hypertension and screening colonoscopies. Kate, take us away.
Yeah, so I am going to talk, as you said, about pharmacotherapy for insomnia in adults. This is going to be a network meta-analysis I'm going to talk about. So this team did what network meta-analysts do. They searched multiple databases and registries to find randomized trials of different kinds of pharmacotherapy for managing insomnia in adults. So ultimately, they found 170 randomized trials, about 48,000 participants, of which 154 were double-blinded. So some of these folks knew what they were getting in one way or another. So they looked at trials looking at the both effectiveness and tolerability of different kinds of pharmacologic treatments in insomnia. So they were looking at both acute management, so that was about an average of 2 weeks, as well as longer-term management of insomnia, so an average of about 25 weeks, half a year or so. They looked at a huge range of agents. This is one of these giant Lancet studies. They've looked at a couple of different kinds of mental health conditions over the last couple of years. So they looked at benzos, non-benzodiazepines, lambexerant, doxepin, melatonin, dexilamine, and serexavant. So they looked at, again, a huge range of different kinds of therapies. Of the included trials, this is going to turn out to be important. About half were rated at low risk of bias, about 20% at an unclear risk of bias, and at about a third at high risk of bias. The studies used a bunch of different kinds of outcome measures. So they did a bunch of what we will describe as statistical gymnastics to estimate different kinds of effect sizes for both effectiveness and tolerability. So results-wise, there were no medications that were both effective and at low risk of adverse effects or discontinuations. Benzos were among the most effective, but unfortunately, they were among the least safe. Most medications had limited or no information at all on safety, including the ones with the most information on effectiveness, so just like with the benzos. Esopiteglone and other Z hypnotics, doxepin and lambexerant, other orexin inhibitors, all appeared somewhat effective, but either had a poor adverse effect profile or no information at all, again, about either adverse effects or safety overall. Interestingly, everyone's favorite over-the-counter sleep aid, melatonin, was not found to be more effective than placebo. Since only about half of the studies were at low risk of bias, the recommendations from the guidelines from the DOD and the VA and the American College of Physicians, which have both come out since, I think the ACP one was from 2019, the DOD one was maybe 2020, don't quote me on either of those, that recommend holding off on those hypnotic agents until sort of second line therapy. Those both seem like good recommendations. Both of those guidelines recommend CBT as first line. And I've had more than one patient tell me that it works pretty well. So for the right patient, right situation, I recommend sometimes CBT apps for patients who are able to access those and self-directed CBT. Like everyone else on earth, I sometimes have trouble getting patients to be able to access CBT. But again, right patient, right recommendation, right situation, and the patient who can access it, it works not bad. Henry, what do you think?
Well, this gives me a chance to reflect a little bit about insomnia in the first place. So for many people, this notion of you need to have 8 hours of sleep every day is kind of like you need to have 8 glasses of water every day. Somebody made that up. It sounds reasonable. But in fact, when it comes to sleep, our sleep needs change over our entire life cycle, right? A newborn sleeps about 23 and a half hours out of a day. And I think as we get older, the amount of sleep that we need just really declines. And so when you have a person who asks about their poor, having say, I'm not sleeping well, you need to find out, what do they mean? If they're not getting the 8 hours, but they're otherwise awakening, feeling refreshed, and they are not falling asleep during the day, you know, using some tool like the Epworth sleepiness scale or something like that to assess the impact, then I think that's a more important conversation. And then the second part, I think, is that exactly the point that you made, is that these medications are generally disappointing. They're marginally effective. Most of the time, we don't know the safety, and especially as our older population comes in and says, well, you know, I'd like to take a medication so that I can fall asleep more easily. We have the trade-off of falls and confusion and things of that nature. So this recurring theme in the research that the harms of therapy are being missing in action is really quite telling.
Gary, your turn.
Yeah. You know, I have two thoughts. Number one is, I don't know to what degree we're intersecting the potential for sleep apnea or disrupted sleep from, restless legs and other sleep-related movement disorders, essentially at night, or breathing disorders with insomnia. And that's a biggie big in my practice anyways. When people come in, they can't sleep, they feel tired during the day. That's kind of my first line of inquiry. The second one, although I see, Kate, that doxepin, which is an older antidepressant, in my neck of the woods, we've been using trazodone and mirtazapine as our go-to pharmaco agents for sleep. Do you know whether or not in this particular study those types of antidepressants were kind of evaluated?
Yeah, I'm going to conflate all of the studies that I just mentioned, and I can't remember which one. I think it was actually the DODVA one that recommended against trazodone, especially, as Henry was just alluding to, the older we get, the less trazodone is recommended because of that risk of adverse effects. But yeah, I agree. I certainly, was trained to use trazodone as a great sleep agent. Works well, few side effects. But apparently that is not true. It does work well, but lots of side effects and unknown safety profile, again, especially among older folks.
Yeah, I definitely share Henry's feeling that you got to ask the patients. So many times I've asked patients, when do you go to bed? Oh, about 8 o'clock. And when do you wake up? Around 6. I'm like, man, you're sleeping really well, And that's always an important first step. Kate, you've got a quiz for us today?
Sure do. The question is, about what percentage of positive tests for depression in a primary care office done using a standardized screening tool like a PHQ-9 will turn out to be a false positive? Is it A, 5%, B, 25%, C, 50%, D, 75%, or E, 90%? Stay tuned for the answer.
Excellent. I think I know the answer. Henry, I love this study, and it completely reversed what I had previously believed. So go for it.
So this is from the Time study published by McKenzie and colleagues in October in Lancet. And it asks whether bedtime administration of blood pressure medications improves outcomes. Now, if you'll think back to episode 100, Kate presented data from the Hygieia chronotherapy trial. And Kate, you asked the question, do we believe it? It was a simple measure that sounded really good. So the Hygieia trial included over 19,000 adults with hypertension and reported that bedtime administration of medications decreased cardiovascular death and morbidity over more than 6 years of follow-up. But the study generated all kinds of furor from people who thought that the results were in fact too good to be true, so much so that the editors of the journal actually sent out the data for secondary analysis, which actually confirmed the what was presented. But part of the furor was also that nobody knew about these studies, and that the concerns were that this might have been all manufactured information. And that's something that still has, it's still out there, but nobody has actually been able to confirm or refute that. So anyway, this, the TIME study basically took 21,000 adults with hypertension, and they randomized them to either take their medication in the morning between 6 and 10 or in the evening between 8 p.m. and midnight. And for they tried to be kind and practical. For those who took their medications in the evening, if they were finding that they were having sleep disruption due to nocturia and the like, that they could then switch over to the morning. So they did an intention to treat analysis. And even though the participants knew when they were taking the medications, the people who were assessing the outcomes didn't. And the main outcomes were vascular death or hospitalization for non-fatal myocardial infarction or non-fatal stroke. And they used registry data to confirm what patients reported and the like. What did they find? Well, after about 5 years of follow-up, that basically 3.5% of each group experienced the endpoint, and the time to the first occurrence was similar. So there really was no differences in all-cause mortality and the like. They also reported that adverse effects, which included excessive trips to the toilet daytime or nighttime, was slightly more than a third in each group. So ultimately, what this tells us is that it's one study, a little bit bigger than the Hygieia trial, but reasonably well done, that says that, you know, it probably really doesn't matter. And we've made this point before. If you have to take other medications in the evening and you don't have a morning one, maybe you can just put it all together and link it to something that you do all the time. But, you know, the medications generally work better when they are in your body than in the bottle. Mark.
Yeah, I know. This is completely different from Hygieia. It does make you really question though that original trial. There's more and more reports of, you know, research misconduct, which of course we have no idea whether or not that happened, but to see such a total reversal is just really interesting. And I have switched back to taking my antihypertensives in the morning from taking them in the evening. So, you know, we try to follow our own advice. But in this case, looks like that was incorrect. Kate?
Yeah, this, of course, breaks my heart because I love those previous trials. It's so simple. Yeah. It did very much feel like just slightly too good to be true. I can't remember what the numbers needed to treat to prevent, like, those maces. Like,
it's huge.
Yeah, but it was 6 or something. It was some very small number needed to treat for very substantial, you know, outcomes. So it did have a little tinge of too good to be true, but such a simple change, if it did turn out to be true. I am sort of waiting, like you said, there is the and has been from the start, this sort of, you know, hint of research misconduct. I kind of can't wait to see what happens next with this, like just from like the sort of the spectacle and the drama perspective. So I can't, this is as good as it gets, of course, in the research world. Like, we don't have reality TV.
There must be thousands of Spaniards out there who know whether or not they were in a study, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they were either in a study or they weren't in a study.
It's not that big a country. And
they should be able to figure this out. You know, some intrepid, you know, cub reporter out there.
I don't think the story's over.
Turning over stones and digging dirt.
Well, not so fast. You know, there are two other studies that are looking at this particular element. And Henry, although, you know, and I jumped on the Hygieia bandwagon as well. But I think there are a couple of nuances to this study that may have influenced the results. When you looked at the non-adherence to scheduled timing, it was about 17% more common in the PM dose than the AM dosing, right? Which certainly could have influenced the potential benefit of evening dosing. And then withdrawals were almost not quite two times as more common in the PM versus the AM dosing as well. So, you know, again, I think this turned out to be a negative study if you're looking at Hygieia. It actually turned out to be a positive study in terms of, hey, it doesn't matter when you take your blood pressure medications. Yeah. There's no added benefit. But on the other hand, there's no added harm. And as Mark pointed out, you know, maybe you're taking other medications at night and it's more convenient. There are, as it turns out, there are two other studies that are looking at this exact same phenomenon. So I don't think the answer is quite yet in.
Well, there are some limitations to this study, as you point out. One, the participants were not blinded. And the second part is alludes to your comment about the transition. So using an intention to treat analysis, it is more conservative. And so the possibility that you lose an effect that's real is actually a potential side effect of the intention to treat analysis.
This is my reality TV right here.
Yeah, and I do remember that they had incredibly good adherence in the Hygieia trial, the Spanish trial.
Almost too good.
Well, yeah, and it was like 99% adherence or something like that. So I think it'll be interesting to see what the other studies find. Here's another study that is really a landmark trial that came back with results that were, at least to me, pretty unexpected. And this was by Brett Hauer, the Nordic Study Group, Effective Colonoscopy Screening on the Risk of Colorectal Cancer and Related Death, New England Journal, volume 387, page 1547. So unexpected findings. These researchers in Europe identified about 95,000 healthy men and women aged 55 to 64 years from the Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, and Poland. None of them had been previously screened for colorectal cancer, and it wasn't being routinely done in those countries or regions. They had to toss out all of the Dutch data from 10,000 Dutch patients because of the ridiculous restrictive data protection laws they have in Europe. The European researchers I know are just tearing out their hair about this kind of thing. And it left 85,000 who were randomized in a 1-to-2 ratio to either a single screening colonoscopy or usual care. The median age when they started the study was 59 years, about half were women. Most of the participants came from Poland or Norway, a smaller number from Sweden. Only 42% of those invited to colonoscopy actually got a colonoscopy. The rest never showed up. The median follow-up was 10 years, so pretty good duration of follow-up. 91% had a very good or good bowel prep. 97% achieved intubation of the cecum, and 31% had an adenoma detected. The U.S. quality standards say they want at least 95% intubation of the cecum and at least 25% adenoma detection. So this is good quality colonoscopy. In the intention to treat analysis, so those who got the colonoscopy compared to those who were randomized to no screening, the incidence of CRC was significantly lower, but not by a lot. It was 0.98%, so just under 1%, versus 1.2%. It was statistically significant, but the number needed to invite to screening over 10 years for a single screening was 455 to prevent one cancer. Mortality was lower, but not in a statistically significant way, 0.28 versus 0.31%, and absolutely no change in all-cause mortality. Now, because of the low adherence, the low, you know, accepting of the invite, they did a separate per-protocol analysis. And you have to be really super careful about that and maintain a high degree of skepticism. But I think what they did it as well as you can. If you just take the people who accept the invitation, they're going to be a healthier bunch with better outcomes no matter what, because these are people who follow instructions and they don't speed and they wear seatbelts and all those good things and they buy Volvos or whatever they do. And so you have to be careful. So what they did was they adjusted for baseline differences between those accepting the invitation and those who ignored it to try to adjust as well as they could for the healthy volunteer bias. And when they did that, they found a larger reduction in the incidence of colorectal cancer, still not terrific, 0.84% versus 1.22%. The number needed to screen now is about 260 to prevent one cancer. They found a significantly greater reduction in colorectal cancer mortality, 0.15 versus 0.3%. On the bright side, complications were rare. There were 15 episodes of major bleeding, about 0.13%, so about one in every 700 people. No fatal events, no perforations, which is pretty remarkable given that they did about 12,000 colonoscopies. So bottom line, first randomized trial of colorectal cancer screening had a significantly smaller than expected reduction in colorectal cancer incidence. You know, the modeling estimates that when I was on the task force and we were presented with this modeling data because we didn't have randomized controlled trial evidence showed much larger reductions that were estimated with colonoscopy or FIT or any kind of colorectal cancer screening. So much lower than expected. I think in part you can explain that. I think only in part you can explain that by treatment has gotten better. This was 10-year follow-up of a single colonoscopy, not a lifetime benefit. Trials comparing FIT with colonoscopy are underway. They should be reporting results in the next few years. I think I've been saying that for a few years, and hopefully those results will, you know, add some clarity. But I'm curious to see what you guys think, Garrett.
Well, what about a higher prevalence population? You know, and is there any reason to believe that these Europeans have any different prevalence of perhaps pre-cancerous lesions in their colon than say the United States population does? I don't know. I mean, there's certainly dietary and obviously genetic influences as well. So I would wonder whether or not if you had a higher prevalence population, whether or not the delta between screening and not screening certainly would be more palatable. And I think, as you point out, too, I've got a surprising number of patients who are reluctant to get a colonoscopy, just mm-hmm. period. But they'll take a FIT test. So they'll take, you know, some of the other, stool based tests as well. And then, you know, I tell them, hey, if it's positive, you're still buying a colonoscopy. So I'm really anxious to see how these non-colonoscopic tests are really going to fare with regards to the colonoscopies. So my comments.
Yeah, big trial results coming. But I think they did have relatively low incidence overall of colorectal cancer in the study and lower than expected, probably. Kate?
Yeah, I think the question is, you know, how does this affect the data that we had previously? And, you know, what led us to make the recommendations that we have and how does this impact that, you know, that modeling data? And does it, you know, do we adjust our models accordingly, sort of, you know, because the most recent, you know, modeling data that we had to make the recommendations that we just got, I think 2020, time has no meaning, but actually said there's an increasing, you know, rate of colorectal cancer and that screening should be more effective and not less effective at preventing both, you know, both disease specific and all cause mortality. So I do wonder, I mean, I think for me, it makes me think, you know, both, is there a difference, just like the points that Gary has raised, is there a difference in population? Is there a difference in healthcare system? Are we going to see a bigger difference with, you know, as time goes on? Or is this real? Is the actual effect of screening not going to be as profound as we thought it was? Is it going to be just a smaller benefit in a, you know, potentially open to there being no benefit and we'll just learn from this as time goes on?
Yeah, I mean, I think they did see a benefit, and it would be a benefit in terms of, you know, really, if you think about the reason to do colonoscopy over other things is to prevent colorectal cancer. It probably does a better job of preventing cancer than the other modalities. I mean, this is an order of magnitude. I mean, the estimates for number needed to screen over a lifetime were in the 40 to 50 range for the modeling data, and this is 450. And that's now it's a single colonoscopy 10 years. The, you know, oldest patients were probably in about 70. So we still have a ways to go, but it's probably going to be somewhere in between the modeling and reality. So
this study almost reminds me of the Women's Health Initiative that really blew the socks off of hormone replacement therapy for the prevention of you name it, right? Mm-hmm. And so the big problem with all of the data that were previously in alignment in favor of hormone replacement therapy couldn't overcome this healthy user phenomenon that Mark alluded to. And I think the modeling data I don't know how well it's able to address that healthy user phenomenon. And granted, these showed some benefit. It just wasn't as good as what we'd expected. And I think that may be at least an important consideration as far as the explanation.
It's a little different from women's health because we did have randomized trial data for fecal occult blood testing that was positive. We had randomized trial data for FlexSig that showed a benefit. So it's not as if there wasn't an evidentiary basis for it, but it's certainly a lot less impressive than we expected.
I'm reminded of the healthy person bias. There's cardiovascular studies a number of years ago showed that people who were randomized to placebo and were adherent to placebo had better outcomes than those who were non-adherent to placebo.
Oh, yeah. Fewer MVAs. You know, they were also, and those people are more likely, this is kind of crossing over here, more likely to attend cancer screenings than people who didn't take their placebo every day. So take your placebo every day, everybody, and you'll be healthy. Yay.
All right, you can get Gary. It at Amazon.com. It's under the brand name of Zeebo.
This is another one. This is another one making me question my daily taking of a hydrochlorothiazide. So now you're just exploding my world here.
You're doing the right thing, man. Okay. So previous studies have suggested that chlorothalidone is superior to hydrochlorothiazide in preventing cardiovascular outcomes. Indeed, chlorothalidone is recommended as a preferred agent by many guidelines. I love this study. I mean, this is they even talk about it as being a pragmatic study. And it's very useful to primary care. The real question is, what's better, hydrochlorothiazide or chlorothalidone for preventing MACEs, the major adverse cardiovascular events? This is a study that randomized over 13,000 patients. They had to be on hydrochlorothiazide at baseline, okay, anywhere between 25 and 50 milligrams. They then randomized them to stopping hydrochlorothiazide and starting chlorothalidone, usual doses between 12.5 and 25 milligrams, and then followed them through for basically two and a half, 3 years or so, and asked the question, was there any difference in they had a 5-point MACE, the usual things like non-fatal MI, stroke, heart failure, hospitalizations, et cetera. They found out that between the two groups, absolutely no difference. It was 10.4 versus 10%, the chlorothalidone versus the hydrochlorothiazide group. They looked at the subcomponents of the primary outcome. The primary outcome was a composite outcome, so they looked at every single one, no difference between the two groups. But they did find there was a slightly higher risk of hypokalemia in the chlorothalidone group, the 6% versus 4.4%. So as far as 2.5 years go, thiazide-type diuretics in this study suggests probably doesn't make a big difference whether you're using chlorothalidone or hydrochlorothiazide if what you're trying to do is prevent, which we're trying to prevent, which are the big MACEs. And so long story short, I think it's put a little bit of a question mark next to those guideline-directed medical therapies that actually prefer chlorothalidone over hydrochlorothiazide.
Kate.
Yeah, so one of the guiding principles of my life is the expression choose your battles. And a long time ago, I just decided that I was never going to pick a battle with anybody who said that chlorothalidone was a better thiazide diuretic than hydrochlorothiazide. And now if somebody was like, hey, you have to do the fine, whatever. But I think it's been clear for a long time that, you know, the difference in blood pressure lowering was trivial. You know, it was like 3 or 4 points. And so it seems very unsurprising that does not translate to you know, a decrease in MACEs of any kind. Now I feel like I have to revisit that. Like, now do I have to pick the battle and be like, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to make any more changes to your, you know, my blood pressure regimens here. But I think I'm going to stick with it though, because it really doesn't matter. And so whatever blood pressure medicine somebody wants me to prescribe, it's fine. Stick with it.
Excellent. Henry?
Not so fast.
Oh, I can't wait. Oh, they're waiting on the edge of my chair.
So remember, this is not a thiazide naive population. These were patients who are already on a thiazide and who have demonstrated probably that they've been able to tolerate a thiazide. And so this is really a study of switching from one to another. Which very analogous to switching from branded Synthroid to generic levothyroxine. So in this case, it's really about switching, and it's not about the initial therapy. And So I think we have to be a little bit more cautious in that regard. The second thing is that this study just triggered flashbacks to when I was an intern many years ago, that we had this practice in Grand Ledge, Michigan, little town, and the clinicians were older as well as were their patients. And invariably, we would have this cluster of patients of theirs who were in the hospital with hyponatremia and hypokalemia, and every one of them were on Hygroton, the brand name for chlorthalidone. And so whenever we would hear that you'd have a patient from Grand Ledge, the first order that you would write would be anti-Hygroton.
It is interesting how little clusters of, you know, medical culture evolved. There was, I was giving a lecture in Florida once, and I love telling the story. And I was talking about pneumonia and flu, and these, this doctor is in the back of the room excitedly raising his hand and waving, said, oh, what we do is we give hydrogen peroxide IV to anybody with the flu or pneumonia, and it cures them. It's like, if it doesn't kill them. You know? And there was three or four doctors, and they all did this in this one little town of, I think, Perry, Florida. So, yeah. So this has been really interesting stuff, man. You know, we now know we can take our blood pressure medicine anytime, not to expect as much of colonoscopy as we used to think. So maybe some of those alternatives are looking better and better. Insomniacs, get an app, right? And it doesn't matter. I can continue to take my hypochlorothiazide. So this is all good, good stuff. Kate, you want to finish us off with the quiz answer?
Yeah, I'm not sure how this is going to help you or not here. The question, again, was about what percentage of positive tests for depression in a primary care office using a standardized screening tool like a PHQ-9 will be a false positive? Is it 5, 25, 50, 75, or 90%? So the answer is D. About 75% of positive tests are false positive. This does seem high. It's important to remember that these tests are done in patients who don't have any complaints or concerns of depression. So these are the screening tests only. Asking patients if they've felt down or depressed recently may provoke some people to acknowledge they have, for various reasons other than major depression. So although we may uncover other diagnoses, many people can have depressed mood without depression. This study assumed a population rate of depression of about 5% and a cutoff of 10, not 5, on the PHQ-9, and predicted 18 positive screenings with only 4 true positives among those. So the moral of the story, all screening tests should be followed with a diagnostic interview, at a minimum asking patients what else is going on in their lives that could have provoked the answers that they had.
Yeah, I think that's great. This is really useful, because I think too often we begin to treat these screening tests as diagnostic, and they're not. They're an initial pass, and you know, that conversation is so important. Great stuff. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Thanks, Henry, Gary, Kate, for your contributions, and thanks, everyone, for listening. If you want a CMEIFP.com online education webpage, they're accredited to provide that CME, and you can read all about it on their website. We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Please tell your friends. We'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.